everyone, and welcome to this new session of Memcast. We're excited to be joined today by Dr. Daniel Pan, infectious diseases registrar, currently doing his PhD in Leicester, and he's going to advise us on what an academic pathway actually is, how to get into it if you guys are interested, and we're just going to have a chat around academic pathway and what that entails. Hello, Dan. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
So with the introduction, we did mention that we're going to talk about academic pathway. So if you introduce yourself, do you want to tell us about what your PhD is on and a bit about academic pathway and what that entails?
Okay, great. So my name is Dan. I am currently an infectious diseases registrar on an out-of-program research where I'm doing a PhD. My PhD is based mainly at the University of Leicester, but is also in collaboration with the University of Oxford and the University Hospitals of Leicester NHS Trust. My research career mainly started from the COVID pandemic. As an infectious diseases registrar, I was one of the first junior doctors to see people with COVID in hospital. And so very naturally, you know, when the whole world was focused on COVID and I had a slightly academic background and research slant, it made sense for me to kind of transition into COVID. And luckily for me, the University of Leicester is actually one of the best universities to research COVID in. We're kind of the top 10 university funded for COVID research in the UK. And so, yeah, so that's how I kind of got into it, and that's what I'm doing now. In terms of what my research is about, I guess if I were to sum it up in one sentence, it's to work out whether when people get infected, if they are infectious to others or not. So currently, as we know, with the nasopharyngeal swab, you're mainly sampling from the virus deep within your nose and throat. But not all that virus, we know, actually goes out into the environment. And so although the swab tests are really good for telling you whether you have COVID or not, I think everyone will have some experience here of some people who've tested COVID positive for a really long time or a very short time. Basically, we know they're not always the most accurate markers of actually telling you whether you're infectious or not. So at the university, we've developed a new way of sampling for COVID where we have a face mask. It's kind of the face mask you wear when you're at work, except they've got strips inside them, and the strips are able to detect virus that people breathe out. So a large part of my PhD is seeing if this works, right? So we're trying to see if the face masks are a better marker of how infectious someone is compared to the standard tests we use, like the lateral flow test for swabs. So that's what my research is on.
Great. And what made you go into research?
So I think I am one of those who didn't really know that I wanted to do research. Basically, what happened was I graduated from Imperial College London, where, because Imperial College London has a very academic background, all the medical students have to do a BSc. So I actually really hated my BSc, and my BSc was in laboratory research. And actually, at the time, funny story, I didn't realize I had astigmatism in my eye. So I was really bad at doing experiments because I couldn't see properly. And it was actually when I discovered that I needed glasses, but my supervisor then wasn't very pleased with the work that I'd done. And I don't think I'd ever go into research from that experience. But I guess what I found out later on when I became a junior doctor was that research comes in all forms and sizes. And what I wasn't suitable for as a medic was laboratory research. But when I was doing my junior doctor years as a foundation year doctor, I found myself asking lots of clinical questions at work that the literature couldn't directly answer. And I found great satisfaction in being able to address these answers by developing my own research projects. So I did an academic foundation rotation in Hull, of all places, in Northeast Yorkshire, in cardiology. And actually, one of the main projects that I did came from when I was in clinic in cardiology, and I saw an elderly chap who was fine. He had heart failure, but he was fine, but he asked me whether he could drive. And I didn't know the answer to that. There's no guidelines about it. I asked my boss. My boss didn't know the answer about it, but he said, why don't you turn that into your project? So for the 2 years whilst I was in Hull, what I did was I worked with a computer design team in the university to come up with a driving simulation. It was quite fun. I really enjoyed it, actually, because I went around Hull taking pictures of the bins and the houses so that the simulation is as accurate as possible for the people who are using it. And then what we did with the driving simulation is that we made people with heart failure drive the driving simulation, and I measured their reaction times. So what happened was they were driving in the driving simulation, and then suddenly a stop sign would come up, and then they would need to press the brake, kind of like how you do a driving test, except safer. And so I measured the time it takes for them to press on the brakes. And actually what I found was that people with heart failure, they have slower reaction times actually than people who don't have heart failure. They have much slower reaction times, but the time it takes for them to actually come to a stop whilst driving is the same. So that actually implies, my deduction from that is that actually people with heart failure are safe to drive because they are aware their reaction times are slower. So they press on the brakes harder. So they still come to a stop in the same period. And I think that really hooked me, that experience of doing research and actually kind of doing something to answer a research question that no one has answered yet. That really kind of hooked me and kind of started me on this path and made me actually want to continue.
Great, thank you for sharing that. It's very interesting. And you actually touched on some topics that we wanted to talk about. So for example, research. I think our listeners, when they think of research, they think of lab work. But obviously, as I'm telling us, it's not all about lab work. So what are the type of research that medics can get into?
So there's loads of research. There's such a high variety of different research that medics can get into. Everyone is very different. In my opinion, I feel like my contribution to the research field is going to be something that's really clinical. So I think as clinicians, we often take for granted how much clinical insight we have about what patients need, because we see them all the time, and to us it might be really obvious. But actually, when you're in an academic job and you talk to others, like laboratory scientists or mathematical modelers, you realize actually that there's a lot of that really, that knowledge that you take for granted that they don't have. So for example, you know, we know by reflex, really, what are the factors that might make people have sepsis? You know, like they're immunocompromised, maybe they are frail and they're elderly. But a statistician relies purely on the data to tell them what are the factors. And often actually what a statistician needs is a clinician to help them be like, look, is this actually sensible? Are these models I'm developing actually sensible and actually align with your clinical experience? So the kind of research I do really is about research for patient benefit. So I do research that is mainly epidemiological, using relatively large data sets, or I go and collect data about patients myself, and then I analyze the data, but it's always the aim of kind of going directly back to the patient and how it would benefit the patient. So it's kind of like a clinician research kind of role, rather than like a, I guess what some may feel like is a true researcher, right? So other researchers you could kind of work on is, for example, laboratory research, where your role is mainly answering questions in the lab, either using animals or using experiments. Or you could be doing potentially entirely modeling work, like for example, mathematical modeling, where you're building mathematical models to try and work out what's going on. Those to me, I think those are harder for me, because I really like clinical medicine, and those disciplines are so far from clinical medicine that I feel like I would need to compromise time spent doing clinical work to be good at those disciplines, which might be suitable for some others, because I also know really good researchers who actually prefer to do less clinical work and focus on their research as well. So there's lots of things for everyone, and we've only talked about, you know, the really basics of clinical research and lab research. In clinical research, you could be a clinical trialist, where you mainly do clinical trials. You could be an epidemiologist, where you kind of look at large data sets. And there's even more subdivisions. So it's really broad.
So I guess one of the questions that comes up quite often in IMT interviews is, what's the difference between an audit or a quality improvement project and the research project? So would you mind enlightening us about it?
So the main difference between an audit QIP and a research project is that an audit and QIP is aiming to see whether we are adhering to a particular standard or not. Whereas research is trying to answer a new question where we don't know the answer and that where there's no standard. A clear example of this would be, for example, that the World Health Organization has specific standards about how well a room should be ventilated. you could ask that question in the context of a hospital and see whether the rooms in the hospital are ventilated to that standard. That is an audit. If you want to turn that into a QR quality improvement project, what you might do is you might collect some data about whether the ventilation in the hospital is up to standard or not. And if it isn't, you might then do an intervention to try and improve the ventilation of the room, for example, by opening a door or opening a window, and you see whether that improves it. You get more data and you constantly do it to try and get to that standard and see if that standard can be maintained. Whereas if it's a research question, it would be actually, you know, does the ventilation of the room affect whether people might get infected or not? You see, there's no standard there. There's nothing there which says X number of people will be infected if you have this number of people, this amount of ventilation. And that would be a research question where you need to actually think carefully about how you design that study to answer it.
Okay, great. Thank you. And now moving on to how do you actually set up a research project and what are the steps that it entails?
So my first advice I would say to trainees who are interested in doing research is I wouldn't perhaps try and embark on that research journey by yourself, because research is full of pitfalls. And really what you want to do with research is at least publish your research in a peer-reviewed journal, which is quite challenging, your first paper. So when I talked about my heart failure driving paper, I started that in 2015 and I published that probably in 2020. So it took me 5 years to really learn how to design a study and publish it from beginning to end. So what you should go and seek out, I think, is a supervisor who knows what they're doing and can usually kind of guide you. And my advice would also be to find a supervisor who is an academic, so either a clinician academic, which is the most suitable, or someone who is an academic. The problem with finding a supervisor who is not paid for their academic role and is a clinician is that they might be really busy. And if they are really busy and not paid to do research, and research takes time, proper research takes time, it means that you might not get the most bang for your buck. You might start the project and then your supervisor might lose interest or gets busy, and then you're kind of left on your own to kind of deal with everything. Having an academic supervisor also makes things much easier, smoother through the process, because to do a research project involving patients, you might need to search for ethical approval, etc., which can be much easier if you have someone who's done it loads of times before in the past.
And let's say you find your topic, find a supervisor that's an academic, and what are the steps afterwards? And is there a timeline you have to frame at the beginning? So how long the project is going to take? Can you do that in a research project, or is it unpredictable?
So it really depends on what you want to answer as a research question. Again, my advice to trainees would be to start off with something that is not super ambitious. And often trainees probably, if you're starting at the beginning, you might not have a great idea of how to answer the research question you want to do. So actually, the first thing you should ask is be really honest with your potential research supervisor. Introduce yourself to them. Ideally have a CV so that they know at what stage you are at, and ask them whether there's any projects that they kind of be willing for you to take part in. And often there will be loads. We have loads. Many people approach me to do this, and often we can give them lots of little projects to do. And I think the important thing about clinical research actually to bear in mind is that it's not necessarily the research that you want to do per se, because clinical research is about research for patient benefit. So you have to answer a question that is relevant to the patients you're looking after, right? Like my research is about COVID because we have so many people with COVID, and it's an important question that needs answering for public health. I would love to do research on trypanosomiasis or leishmania. But the reality is, where am I going to find those patients in the UK? It's more difficult for me to do that, especially as a trainee. So, you know, start small, find a supervisor, and be realistic with your plans. And often the supervisors can tailor research projects which suit the plans and your stage of training.
And we're going to have another podcast episode where we're going to discuss about hierarchy of studies from clinical studies to research project and PhDs. Okay, so we went through thinking about the project, getting a supervisor, and what are your tips from a personal experience as well about balancing doing a research project and doing clinical work? Because obviously with an cold rota and probably in the beginning when people aren't doing a PhD, they have to do it at the same time.
I think this is a really important question, and thank you for asking it. I think the most important thing to bear in mind with research, in my opinion, is why you would like to do a research project. So again, it's that big question of where do you see yourself in 10 years' time? Do you see yourself as mainly a clinical consultant with, you know, an interest in research? Or do you see yourself perhaps actually doing more of the research and engaging in the research and maybe, you know, become a professor or something like that? Because those are very two different pathways. The clinical academic pathway is a very different pathway to the clinical pathway. For IMTs, you would start off by thinking about applying for an academic clinical fellowship. And the main aim of that is to basically, for most IMTs, is to get a PhD. So the academic clinical fellowship, the benefit of the academic clinical fellowship is that it allows you to have time during your training where you can be spending it doing research. So you will get paid a clinical salary to do research. And it basically allows you to collect some pilot data that you can then use to apply for a PhD. There's multiple ways of applying for a PhD. One way, the main problem with PhDs for clinicians is actually the funding. So PhD students don't get paid quite a lot. So most clinicians would not do a PhD if they then suddenly downgraded to what a PhD student is actually paid for. So you need to get a clinical PhD salary. And to get a clinical PhD salary, either you find a supervisor who's got money to pay for your salary for 3 years, or you apply for a fellowship grant where actually you compete with others to get a PhD awarded by some funding bodies. There's multiple funding bodies that are available for this, depending on your specialty. So, for example, in cardiology, where it's very research heavy, there's often charities like the British Heart Foundation, and the Leavers Whom Trust, who will fund you to do your research through a competitive application process. The biggest kind of fellowships that are available, if you like, are those funded by three main research bodies in the UK. That's the NIHR, the MRC, or sometimes it's called the UKRI now, and also the Wellcome Trust. And so those are the most competitive fellowships. Usually they award about 20 people every year with these fellowships, from all specialties. So you're competing against everyone, which is why the academic clinical fellowship is really important for you to build pilot data so that you can convince people to fund you rather than someone else. It's also possible to apply for these fellowships or get a PhD without the need for an academic clinical fellowship, but it would mean that you would be spending more of your own time doing the research because you don't have the clinical time. That's why the ACF is good, because it allows you to do research during your working hours rather than kind of, you know, on your annual leave or whatever. And then after the PhD, you know, I'll talk less about this because I'm going to presume most people are thinking about that first. If you then want to continue on the academic pathway, you would then progress to being a lecturer and then a senior lecturer, associate professor, and a professor. And the further you go down this pathway, the more distant you become from clinical practice, in the sense that your salary is being paid more and more by the university, which means, for example, a full research professor, his salary is dictated by his publications and his research, with only a smaller proportion of it being paid for his clinical work, which is why you might see lots of professors not spending that much time in the hospital, because they are not funded to do so. And that's the main difference, really. So basically, if you go down the full academic pathway, your job becomes to do research rather than research being something extra that most clinicians do as like an extra bow to their string, or as even a hobby, right? And as you further go down this pathway, it becomes more and more of a commitment. that's the main difference, really. Yeah.
And how have you managed to balance your obvious love for clinical work and doing research, which takes you away from clinical work? How do you manage to do that?
The way I see it, basically, is, first of all, I've been influenced by, as with many things, the path you go down is influenced by the people that surround you. And I have many mentors who have done this, who have kind of had a very healthy balance of clinical and academic jobs, rather than full clinical or full academic. There are, you know, I make it sound like the academic career is tough, but there's also some good pros of an academic career. So, for example, if you're doing research and your research is clinical research, not in the lab, or even if it's kind of modeling where you're looking at big data sets, on your research days, your time is your own. It's kind of flexible. You still have to do lots of work, but for example, you could get up a bit later. There's no specific time to be in and out of work. And sometimes having a flexible schedule can be quite good for life. So that's where the academic pathway is kind of, for me, is like a benefit. I kind of choose my working times rather than kind of making it specifically from 8. I can miss, like, you know, the rush hour traffic, etc., etc., etc. So the most important thing about balancing this is to be very clear about what your end goal is. So if your end goal is basically to do a little bit of research, understand research, but still go back to clinical, then, you know, I would suggest that basically you don't need to prioritize the research and you just do a bit in your spare time, and you don't need to do that much in your spare time. Just go and learn a little bit so that you understand what the research process is about and get, you know, a few papers on your CV, and that's fine. If you want to do research as a career, I do think at the very start, as with anything, you will be doing a lot of stuff in your own time, because you're basically learning a new discipline. You're learning how research works, and you need to spend time outside your clinical work doing these things. But it's always with the aim of, for example, getting an academic clinical fellowship or lectureship or PhD, so that you can then do it within your working hours. So the idea is you start off by doing it out, like you have to dedicate some more time to do it. But then eventually it gets much better, and you should aim to do it within your working hours once you've achieved that kind of balance where you're paid to do the research in your working hours time. But when you're not paid to do research, you want to do research properly, it's just inevitable that you have to dedicate some time to do it, unfortunately.
So I think your main advice from it is, if they decide they want to pursue an academic pathway, to start early.
Yeah, I mean, so basically be clear about kind of what you want by exploring research. Find the right supervisors to try and do that. And then if you've decided you feel like this is for you because you enjoy it, rather than perhaps kind of just adding another string to your brain, something that you want to pursue for the rest of your life, then at the start you need to dedicate some more time to it. But ultimately it's you can't do that forever. So ultimately the aim is to still achieve a work-life balance by having a job which gives you that balance.
Okay, great. So to conclude this podcast, because we're going to talk more about the types of research and what can people publish and a bit about statistics in our next podcast episode, which you guys have to keep an eye out for. But to sum up this one, so what are your then top tips for, let's say, because this podcast is aimed at internal medical trainees, for IMTs that want to pursue an academic pathway?
So tip one, keep an eye out for good supervisors and approach them. Have a good CV. When I say good, I mean just like well laid out. Don't necessarily mean you need to have publication or anything to present to that supervisor. Second tip is just be wary about what you take on. Because whatever, you can say no to whatever people would like for you to do, but once you've taken that project on, it's highly recommended that you finish it and you complete it. And then my third tip would be, recognize that you may need to spend some extra effort and energy in your spare time to do research if you want to do it as a full-time career, but eventually you should aim to have it kind of embedded within your working day.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Dan. This was an excellent talk that I think will help many, many people. And thank you for joining us today, and join us again for a new episode.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.